So some of you may be relieved and others disappointed to know that this is our last public panel of the symposium. From here we go into a private session for fellows only, which I'll talk about after the current panel. But we're ending with a bang, so to speak. We want to talk about pretrial detention, which is sort of a follow-on to an activity at a conference we had last spring in New Orleans. Some of you were actually there as fellows, and we married it to the 50th anniversary of Gideon versus Wainwright decision, which is happening this year, on indigent defense. The two obviously go together. We're going to be doing a lot of activities, we hope, over this year to mark the anniversary, but also to find out what hasn't been achieved or where we've fallen back since the Gideon versus Wainwright decision. So this panel, which really follows the same name as the one we had in New Orleans, but the title still is very apt, Jailed Without Conviction. And to lead us, we have Maurice Posley, who is the was the coordinator for our panel in New Orleans. And Maurice is, again, someone who really needs very little introduction to the journalistic community. He's been a longtime investigative reporter for the Chicago Trib, co-winner of the Pulitzer Prize for a series of investigative pieces he did. And he's been a coordinator for a lot of our projects and a contributor to the Crime Report as well. And he was an investigative researcher for the Northern California Innocence Project's Veritas Initiative last year. He's an author. He's written two very good books. You can read all about him in your program. But to keep things moving, I want to turn it over to Maurice.
Thank you, Steve. You hear me okay? This is, I think, going to be a really interesting panel. These folks all have an incredible amount of information on the subjects of pretrial. I prefer to say pretrial release rather than pretrial detention. Sort of looking through the prism a different way, indigent defense, which is something that I've been fascinated with for a long time, and it's particularly appropriate with in March. It's the 50th anniversary of. It is a landmark, you know, that ruling. You hear that term a lot, but it definitely is a landmark ruling, and we'll hear a little bit about that today. Going from my left is Tim Murray, who's the executive director of the Pretrial Justice Institute, a tremendous resource. It's a nonprofit group in Washington that's got funding support from the Department of Justice. I came to meet him through our work with on the pretrial release efforts, and you can read about his bio, but he's been working in the criminal justice system for 40 years on the just about every level possible. He's also the executive director for the Institute of Justice Planning, which provides planning support to jurisdictions engaged in criminal justice reform. To his left is Norm Reimer, who's the executive director of the NACDL, the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. And in the interest of full disclosure, while working at the Tribune, I was fortunate enough to receive a couple of awards, Champion of Justice Awards, for the reporting work that we did. He's been a criminal defense lawyer for 28 years. He's played a leading role in helping persuade the American Bar Association to adopt a policy calling for mandatory recording of all custodial interrogations. And I can't tell you how important that is. He's a recipient of the Champion of Indigent Defense Award presented by the NACDL, among many other awards. To his left is Justine Olderman, who's a managing attorney of a criminal defense practice at the Bronx Public Defender's Office. Before she joined the Public Defenders there in 2000, she spent 2 years clerking for Judge Robert Ward in the Southern District of New York. She's a graduated magna cum laude in Order of the Coif, is that how you pronounce that? From New York University School of Law. She teaches CLE courses on persuading through storytelling, which I think is just fascinating. And to her left is Karen Hoopert, who is has been a fellow. She's a contributing writer at Washington Post magazine, freelances for a number of publications, New York Times, Newsday, The Nation, Mother Jones, Salon, Slate. It's a long list. Her third book, Chasing Gideon, The Elusive Quest for Poor People's Justice, is going to be released next month. And it really takes a critical and deep look at the state of indigent defense in this country. I'd like to start with Tim and sort of move. I think Justine's going to go last, going to bat cleanup for us, to talk about pretrial release in this country. Sort of give us, for those, a little short primer. But tell us what's going on in this country.
Thanks, Maurice. Good afternoon, everyone. I have to tell you before I get started, I took the train up here from D.C. this morning, so I was getting ready, putting on my tie. I said to my bride, honey, in your wildest dreams, did you ever think that I would be asked to come up and address the Guggenheim Fellows about pretrial justice? Without a blink, my bride looked back at me and said, sugar, my wildest dreams have nothing to do with either you or the Guggenheim. Okay. Two out of three people in America's jails, as we sit here, are not there because they're being punished for a crime. They're not there because they're so stinking scary and dangerous we have to keep them in a cage. They are there because they are presumed innocent pretrial defendants, unable to come up with the currency for pretrial release. That currency is cash. Almost all of them have, in fact, been released by the court when the court has named an amount of money needed for them to put on the table so they can walk out the door unencumbered by monitoring, supervision, or anyone paying any attention to them. They are the results of a bail system in this country that is fundamentally incapable of doing what we expect it to do. By its very design, it cannot work. It pays no attention to risk at either end of the scale. The safest defendant who has no cash is going to stay in a cage. The most dangerous defendant who has access to money is going to be able to purchase their release. Ladies and gentlemen, no amount of money is going to make the most dangerous defendant less dangerous. No amount of jail is going to make a low-risk presumed innocent defendant anything other than a higher-risk presumed innocent defendant. And you and I pay about $9 billion with a B for this crazy, indefensible system annually. Before we go off on a tangent and talk about rape and robbery and murder, let's get an assessment of what we're talking about. Less than 3% of those who get booked into our nation's jails are sentenced to prison. Less than 3%. The bread and butter case that comes through our criminal courts day after day, night after night, are essentially nonviolent, lower-level charges. Yet, we use cash to determine whether or not they will assist their attorney with their defense, whether or not they will go home and pay that week's rent, whether or not they will show up tomorrow at the day laborers' pickup where they're employed. We use cash to determine. And the way we come up with how much cash is even more fascinating. Because in most courts in this country, there's a laminated card. And on that card is the listing of the charge title, let's say car theft, and a money mill. And it doesn't matter if you're Mother Teresa or Jesse James, that's your bond. And you move over one county in the same state, the money amount's different. How do they come up with the money amounts? They make them up. Bunch of people sit around a table, say, geez, you know, I think the bond feels low for car theft. What do you say we raise it, Norm? Yeah, I think that, right, Tim. Cars cost more money these days. Really? Because they have given us a ridiculously small amount of time, and I use most of mine for my opening joke. Let me tell you about the reform to a system that inherently discriminates against those who have no money and turns a blind eye towards danger. And as I hold up that reform, let me just throw one more at the target of the damage currently done by the bail system as it exists in America. If we take two individuals who are virtually identical in terms of charge, what they've been arrested for, and their criminal history, the only difference between those two is you lock one up pending trial and you let the other one out. The one who's out is 4.5 times more likely to stay out at sentencing than the one who's locked up. Switch places. The only difference between the two of them is you kept one in a cage and you let the other one out. 4.5 times more likely. And we've just seen some emerging research that shows if the only difference was you kept one in jail pending trial, the one you kept in jail is more likely to commit additional crime because the only factor we can identify that's different between the two because of the fact that one was locked up and one wasn't. We have a system of justice for the haves. We have a different system of justice for the have-nots. It's one that continues to punish from the very first decision, and it punishes their socio and economic status without regard to community safety, without regard to likelihood of appearance. And yet, when we try and change it, our criminal justice professionals push back and say, gee, I think it's working out great. What's wrong with the current system? I have a 16-year-old daughter. She's learning to drive. Duck and cover. When I go to Allstate and I say, how much to insure my princess? They say $28 trillion. I go, well, how much to insure me? They go, 59 cents. Does that mean I won't have an accident? No. Does that mean she will? No. Well, maybe in her case it does. Let me take that back. But they use actuarial data identifying characteristics of those who are higher risk. We have the same actuarial data that can be applied consistent with law, consistent with the presumption of innocence, that can identify whether or not someone has characteristics that would illuminate their chances of doing everything we ask of them and thus be able to facilitate their release. We've had these data for a long time. To be able to apply a risk assessment at the front end to help inform decision makers is a concept that was just endorsed last week by the National Conference of Chief Justices. It's the chief appellate judge of every state Supreme Court. Your chief judge in New York just came out and with his State of the Judiciary earlier, where he focused on bail. The International Association of Chiefs of Police, the Association of Prosecuting Attorneys, the National Legal Aid and Defenders Association, the National Association of Counties, all within the last 2 years, have publicly demanded that we pull down this hypocrisy that we call bail for profit in this country and replace it with something that's safe, effective, and fair. Thank you.
Thank you. Norm.
Yeah, go ahead and applaud.
Yeah.
Tim is doing phenomenal work. I prefer to stand. It's a little easier for me to communicate than when I'm sitting down. And I want to begin by confessing, Tim, that I didn't even tell my wife where I was going today. Thank you. I'm very honored to be here. I appreciate the invitation to be part of this program and particularly of this panel. In planning the program, Maurice asked me to talk a little bit more generally about the state of indigent defense, and I welcome that opportunity. You heard that I've been a defense lawyer for most of my career, and for those of us who are defense lawyers, representing the accused is what we live and breathe for, as I'm sure you're going to hear from the next two panelists, who are going to one's going to tell the story and one's going to give the perspective of somebody who is right now in the trenches representing individuals on a daily basis. You know, it's a mission, it's a passion, and it's one of the few jobs that's actually ordained in the Constitution. So it's a very great honor. And I also especially welcome talking about indigent defense right now on behalf of my organization, the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, because we have launched a 15-month celebration of Gideon. Why 15 months? Well, first of all, there's so much to do that you can't do it just around one day. Secondly, we thought it would be appropriate to start the celebration back in January of last year on the date when Clarence Earl Gideon wrote his handwritten petition to the Supreme Court that started the process which culminated in the decision in March of 1963. We believe that the centerpiece of any celebration of Gideon has to be action to make its promise a reality for everybody, because it is not a reality for everybody in this country, and people need to know that, notwithstanding what television shows may depict. It is not a reality. When you think about the countless thousands, hundreds of thousands of people that Tim is referring to, who are jailed at any moment in this country, most of whom have not been convicted, and many of whom never will be convicted, that is a national disgrace that we should all be ashamed of. I actually think that instead of entitling the panel, the full title is Rethinking Pretrial Detention During the 50th Anniversary of Gideon, we really should have called it Rethinking Gideon During the Era of Pretrial Detention. And make no mistake about it, this is an era of pretrial detention. So to honor this landmark decision, my organization has adopted three core principles to address access to counsel and pretrial justice reform. And I want to use that as a platform to discuss the state of indigent defense in the country. And I believe that these three principles are absolutely essential if we're going to reduce the number of people who are jailed in this country, especially pretrial. The first of these is pretrial justice reform, which I'm going to speak about in some length. The second is that there should be an absolute right to counsel at the first appearance at which liberty is at risk. And the third is breaking new ground. We believe that there should be an absolute right to counsel at any appearance at which a plea of guilty may be entered. Gideon, as it stands right now, only applies to cases where jail will be imposed, and that's a very important distinction, as I will make clear. All of these implicate the Gideon decision and the right to counsel. Now, let me show you how these relate, how each of these three principles relate to our thinking about Gideon and the right to counsel. On the subject of pretrial justice reform, largely, I must say, through the efforts of Tim and his team, our board finally took this issue up. The criminal defense bar has been late coming to this issue, but we did take it up within the last year, and we have now formally adopted the principles which Tim and Pretrial Justice Institute espouse. We support an independent pretrial justice services agency and an evidence-based release system. We support presumptive release on recognizance, and if that is not possible, that release should be granted on the least onerous conditions possible. Financial conditions, as in our view, should be used only as an absolute last resort and then only with due regard for an individual's financial circumstances. Bail should never be a de facto order of detention. We also support the elimination of commercially compensated sureties. I completely agree with Tim that intelligent evidence-based practices which presumptively release persons on the least restrictive conditions appropriate is a long overdue reform. The work that he has done, I have to tell you this in all candor, just in the last couple of years, watching what you have done, working with the Justice Department, I know that their having that conference was probably because of your prodding, has been truly phenomenal. And we do it at long last, at least have a national conversation going. Money bail is, in fact, the least efficient and most retrogressive means of ensuring a person's return to court. Few people who are bound and determined to abscond will ever be deterred by the loss of money. And certainly when the amount is relatively small, a couple of $100, $500, $1,000, $25, it's no deterrent at all. But it is enough to massively imprison the poor people in this country. In addition, in most places in this country, as Tim said, there isn't even a pretense that bail is used to guarantee court appearance. It's used to punish. It is often set, as Tim said, pursuant to those laminated cards, which have no basis in reality and certainly have no regard for the current personal circumstances of the accused. We also know, I know from firsthand experience of 28 years in practice, that bail is used as ransom by prosecutors and judges to extract guilty pleas. That is a fact. It is also used by judges to inoculate themselves against the firestorm of media-stoked hysteria that they fear if a released defendant commits an atrocious crime. And parenthetically, I should say that these kinds of attacks on judges, which are, in my opinion, red meat for the ignorant masses, have no correlation to reality. Millions of people are arrested in this country every year. Millions are arrested every year. And there is absolutely no nexus between most minor arrests and the eventual commission of an act of violence. As a matter of fact, and we've seen this over and over again, some of the worst crimes are committed by people who have no history whatsoever of criminal behavior and whose conduct is entirely or largely certainly unforeseeable to the criminal justice system. This misuse of bail as judicial cover is at the heart of mass incarceration of the accused people in this country. In this regard, I want to note that NACDL's policy, I know this has probably caused him some disappointment, doesn't explicitly endorse a mechanism for pretrial detention, although I would argue that it implicitly does. Now, we all know that there are some people, based on their prior history or the nature of the alleged crime, who are simply too dangerous to release, and there needs to be a mechanism to keep them in custody. Surely, if one of these deranged shooters were to be arrested, nobody would seriously suggest that they should be released under any conditions. So I recognize that. But I want to explain the reason why the defense bar has treaded lightly in this area. This is a very difficult step for us to take, precisely because of the abuse of pretrial release determinations by both prosecutors and judges. I recognize that abuse is not inevitable. Far from it. The system in the District of Columbia courts is a model for the nation. Tim's board chairman, Truman Morrison, a D.C. Superior Court judge, has built a system that actually releases 85% of all people. And from what I understand, there's virtually no person that remains in jail because they can't afford bail. I would welcome it if that system could be replicated elsewhere. But there is a cautionary tale that cannot be overlooked. The Bail Reform Act of 1984 established a mechanism for federal pretrial detention. To be sure, those who qualify for release can often do so simply by signing a recognizance bond or having friends and family or coworkers do so. But it also provides for detention based on perceived risk of flight or dangerousness. Now, early in the history of that Bail Act, and I'm sorry to say I remember this case and was practicing, it was in 1984, a case against called U.S. against Salerno, the act was challenged on due process and Eighth Amendment excessive bail challenges. It was upheld. And in his decision, Chief Justice Rehnquist wrote, "In our society, liberty is the norm, and detention prior to trial or without trial is the carefully limited exception." Well, looking at it now, just how carefully limited is that exception in the federal system 30 years later? These are statistics from June of 2012. This does not include immigration cases. So anybody who has an immigration detainer is not included in these statistics. In all federal cases, 56.7% of all accused persons are detained and never released prior to case disposition. Only 43% get released. We have 37,585 out of more than 66,000 who are detained with no conditions of release. And I submit that that, too, is a disgrace. These are not predominantly violent people. The federal government can readily provide the most sophisticated monitoring that science has devised. There is no excuse except the obvious truth that detention is used to coerce guilty pleas and cooperation and provide cover for judges. So while we do believe in an evidence-based system, and we do understand that there's going to have to be a mechanism for pretrial detention, I'm only making the case that we have to proceed very carefully, because if you give this tool to a lot of the local judges in this country, you will see horrific numbers of people detained. So it's just something we have to work on as we work through this this reform. But I concede absolutely the status quo, the current bail system, is a joke. It has to be eliminated, and we've got to fight for that change. The second principle that we have adopted, I think, will also directly increase release percentages. And that is, first and foremost, you have to have a lawyer present when the person makes their first appearance. When under the current system, bail is set, or under a reform system, a judge is going to consider the conditions of release, someone has to make the case for the accused person. Many of these people suffer from all kinds of pathologies. Some are terrified. All are terrified. Many of them speak another language or have mental impairments or substance abuse problems. I know that Justine is going to talk about how important it is to have a holistic approach that can deal with those issues and how it can make a huge difference in getting people released. But you certainly can't get them released if you don't have a lawyer there. And a close corollary to that is you've got to have a zealous lawyer, a committed lawyer, an engaged lawyer. Far too many lawyers, and this is the defense bar's problem, and we're going to try to do something about it. Far too many lawyers do not prepare adequately to make the case for release, and far fewer challenge the decisions of judges that keep their clients in jail. This has to change, and it can change. In Kentucky, the Public Defense Commission has launched a statewide plan to better equip lawyers to advocate for release, and it is already showing impressive results. And I'm actually quite pleased to say that the chief of their system, Ed Monahan, who has pioneered that project, is now co-chairing a task force along with Professor Adele Bernard from Pace University to develop a national resource for NACDL and the defense bar so that we can have people who are really doing a great job of advocating. So as those are the first two reforms, pretrial justice and making sure we have a lawyer at the first appearance. As I turn to the third one, I do want to put this Gideon decision in some context and then give you some snippets of what the problems are right now. That decision is among the truly most significant decisions in jurisprudential history. You cannot lose sight of how amazing it is that we have a principle that the same government that is prosecuting someone has an obligation to provide an attorney for someone. That is truly America's gift to the world. And there are now 65 national constitutions that have the right to counsel and 24 that provide, go beyond our own Bill of Rights and provide that it must be provided for people who are indigent at the government's cost. Now, undoubtedly, in many of those places, that's a right that's on the books and not enforced, but that is also the case here in the United States. Our courts have become, particularly our misdemeanor courts, have become plea mills where we are mass-producing convictions and depriving the accused of the right to counsel. 2 years ago, NACDL studied the misdemeanor courts in Florida. We came out with a report called 3-Minute Justice that looked at 21 counties in the state of Florida. Nearly 500,000 people, 3% of the state's adult population, pass through the courts every year. The average arraignment proceeding lasted 2.93 minutes. 66 did not have a lawyer. Judges asked defendants if they wanted a lawyer less than half the time. The former Chief Justice of Florida, Gerald Kogan, called the courts in that state a constitution-free zone. In Colorado, NACDL is challenging a statute that requires misdemeanor defendants to meet with the prosecutor before counsel will be appointed. Not surprisingly, many of them are persuaded to plead guilty without ever seeing a lawyer. In Texas, where there are 254 counties, each with their own system, similar abuses are common. In Williamson County, for years, judges routinely declined to appoint counsel in misdemeanor cases. That led to a lawsuit, Heckman against Williamson County. Let me just tell you about Kerry Heckman. He lived in the town of Bartlett and was arrested, this goes back to 2006, for driving while intoxicated. He was a seasonal farm worker who was indigent. In the season when he worked, he made $6.50 an hour. He had no assets, no savings, no bank account. His truck had recently been seized for nonpayment. So he couldn't hire a lawyer. As alleged in the complaint in the lawsuit against Williamson County, he was encouraged by court officials to plead guilty and encouraged to work out the terms of his sentence with the prosecutor. He declined, and he asked the court to give him a lawyer. The court responded by saying to him, "Will you look healthy and well-dressed?" I mean, he had worn his best clothes to court. "And as a result of that, you don't qualify for a lawyer." No one ever asked him about his financial condition. Nobody asked him if there was any reasonable way that he could get a lawyer. But the judge did give Kerry a warning. He said, "If you come to court for the next appearance without an attorney, your bail will be raised." That's why I say we should be rethinking Gideon in the era of pretrial detention. Now, last June, there was a favorable decision on the procedural issues in the case, and I'm happy to report that in December they settled it, and Williamson County now has good procedures in place. But NACDL has learned of other counties in Texas where the same thing is going on. Even though they have an Indigent Defense Commission in Texas that's doing a great job and have provided qualified lawyers in some of these counties, the judges are still refusing to appoint them. They think it's going to take up too much time. It's going to slow down the process. And right here in New York, you have the Hurl Herring lawsuit, which involves similar issues. And what we thought were people languishing in jail just without counsel, just in the town and village courts, we now know also include the city courts as well. In Maryland, they have a commission system where the accused has no right to counsel when bail is initially set. That, too, is in litigation. It's been bouncing back and forth between the Supreme Court of Maryland and the Court of Appeals in Maryland and the legislature. There's another dimension to this, and that I'm sure you're going to hear from Karen about this, are the crushing caseloads under which many indigent defense lawyers labor. This is one of the principal causes of what we call meet and plead practices in this country, which is the practice of lawyers meeting their clients and having them plead guilty at the first appearance. Overburdened systems place a premium on dispositions, and bail, as I said, is frequently used by prosecutors to get these people to plead guilty. Now, pleas at arraignment at the first appearance should be the rare exception, but they have become commonplace. And the reason is because all too often the alternative will be the person will not be able to make that financial bail. They won't be able to get out. This has resulted in a major caseload challenge in the state of Missouri, a case called State v. Waters, where after a favorable decision holding that at some point a public defender can decline to take new cases, that case has been remanded to the trial courts to conduct what they call triage, which is to find a way to solve the problem. Now, the result is great. Public defenders can refuse to take on too many cases, but this is a potentially terrifying remedy. One resolution that has been bandied about is the possibility of having the prosecutor take jail off the table for various misdemeanors. Now, that might sound like a great solution, right? But actually, in my view, that would be a catastrophe, and that leads to the third and final principle that we're espousing, which is that counsel must be provided whenever a guilty plea may be entered. This is a significant suggestion that we expand Gideon so that anyone who's convicted of a crime in this country has a right to a lawyer. Because we don't just live in the age of pretrial detention, we live in the age of collateral consequences. Those silent, hidden consequences of criminal convictions that ruin people's lives. The ABA has a project where they're trying to catalog these consequences, and they have come up with, so far, 45,000 of them. Now, we all know about the Padilla case, or many of us know about the Padilla case, where the Supreme Court said it's ineffective to fail to advise about the immigration consequences of a guilty plea. But what about the employment consequences? What about the loss of family rights, denial of access to student loans or admission to college, licensing prohibitions? The list is endless. And worst of all, and here is where this relates to pretrial justice reform, the fact of a prior conviction vastly increases the prospect that a future arrest will result in higher bail and vastly increases the eventual sentence. So I want to turn finally to the case of Luis Lopez, which was reported by Jeremy Borden in the Washington Post a week ago. It's a terrific piece of reporting. Luis Lopez, 19 years old, pled guilty to a misdemeanor charge without a lawyer. 2 months later, he was deported. And this is commonplace. 41 years ago, in the Archer Singer case, which first extended Gideon to misdemeanors, Justice Lewis Powell saw this coming. In his concurrence, he warned of, quote, an obsession for speedy dispositions, an inevitable consequence of volume is the almost total preoccupation in such courts with the movement of cases. And two generations before this current cascade of collateral consequences and results like what you have with Luis Lopez, Powell said this: serious consequences may also result from convictions not punishable by imprisonment. When the deprivation of rights and interests is of significant consequence, denying the assistance of counsel to indigents who are incapable of defending themselves is a denial of due process. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court in Scott v. Illinois limited Gideon to cases of actual imprisonment. And now we find ourselves in this 50th anniversary year of Gideon, where it is ineffective not to advise an immigrant of the consequences of his plea, but it is okay not to provide a lawyer altogether. And as reported in that article, the idea of taking jail off the table to avoid having to appoint counsel is systemic. This is unacceptable, and it is unworthy of our American system of justice. Early and universal access to counsel, qualified counsel, counsel with adequate resources and manageable caseloads is essential if we are to truly reform our system, and in doing so, end the mass incarceration that so many presumptively innocent people suffer in this country. That would be a fitting tribute in this Gideon anniversary year. I am increasingly hopeful that there are so many in the media who are now willing to move beyond the Greek chorus mentality that has so struck fear into judges' hearts and have begun, just begun, but importantly begun, in the words of the title of this conference, to change how we think about crime and punishment and how we report it. It's long overdue. Thank you. Thank you.
Turn.
Hi. I wanted to kind of segue off of what the experts here have been saying to talk a little bit about the reporting part of this story. And just to get a sense, how many in the room are journalists, if you could raise your hand? Okay. All right, good. Glad to hear it. So am I. And I am here to talk about the process of reporting these kinds of issues, which I've been doing for the last year and a half working on my book, which is called Chasing Gideon, The Elusive Quest for Poor People's Justice. It comes out on March 18th, and I would love to offer all the journalists in the room a free press copy of the book, so I'm going to pass around a sign-up sheet. And I offer this book to you guys out there because I know that you're all writing about similar sorts of issues, and this can perhaps be a kind of background study for you, and also because I think that probably all of you are facing similar challenges that I did when I got the contract to write this book, which is, sometimes you say these words alone, indigent defense, and I always talk about my work, and my friends, their eyes glaze over. Everybody's eyes glaze over. They don't even know what indigent defense means often, and these are smart people, right? But I think writing about this issue is hard because it's complicated, and the various pieces of the puzzle fit together in the criminal justice system in ways that the general public doesn't really understand. So telling a compelling story about criminal justice that goes beyond the kind of crime and punishment narrative that we're most familiar with is really a challenge for journalists. So one of the things that I've found is that you really have to try to tell the story both narratively and by providing the context sections, which all of you guys know. And I'm assuming that all of you guys have similar struggles that I have had for different magazines or newspapers that I've worked with, which is one wants to tug you toward all context and analysis. And I think here of my work for The Nation magazine, it's hard to even squeeze in an anecdote sometimes. And then other places like the Washington Post magazine, where I've worked a lot, which is heavy on the narrative. They want you to tell a long narrative, and I have to fight to get the context sections in there. So I wanted to talk just a little bit about how we deal with this, and not that I've come up with any great solutions. I don't know, I feel like it's maybe like a little bit like AA here. You know, I share your pain, basically. I, too, am a recovering journalist addicted to narrative and context, right? Because to my mind, the anecdote or the narrative or that emotional part of the story, that's what draws the reader in and makes them feel. And the context part, it makes them want to act to solve this problem or to solve this crisis. And then the context part is the bit that gives them direction. Where do I go? How do I solve the problem? What is the problem exactly? So I know that all of us are kind of struggling with that. And personally, I've gone, you know, a kind of dialectic from doing these sorts of stories and fighting with editors and then throwing up my hands and saying, I give up. I'm not doing any more articles. I'm going to write a book. And then I write a book and I'm like, oh my God, I'm never writing a book again. This has just been the most horrible thing. So that kind of perennial dialectic of dissatisfaction, I guess, is what kind of keeps me going. And I hope that some of the things that I have to say will lead into our next discussion after this, which is when the journalists hang out by ourselves and talk about strategies for writing about these issues. So in my case, I wanted to really break the story down and tell this story for general readers and make them care about this issue. And I did that by picking sort of four people to profile in great detail and four locations. So I wrote about Washington State's indigent defense crisis. I wrote about Florida's. I wrote about Georgia's. And I wrote about Louisiana, in particular New Orleans. And one of the reasons that I wrote about New Orleans was because there was sort of a perfect storm of problems there all across the system. And it was a way of looking at the crisis in indigent defense that showed the interconnectedness of things and allowed also the complexities to exist. So pretty much in New Orleans, there was something profoundly wrong with almost every aspect of the system. From the jails that were completely overcrowded and run as a kind of fiefdom there, to the public defense office, which was in a huge financial crisis and had had to lay off 27 public defenders, leaving people languishing in the jails, to the battle to get pretrial detention there. I was actually able to finally get into the jail thanks to John Jay when I was down there for a conference and met the sheriff at the John Jay conference and finally was able to get into the jail after trying for 2 months to look at the pretrial detention program there that was just getting off the ground and was an effort to also alleviate some of the overcrowding in the jails. So there was crisis everywhere, and I, you know, was trying to think of ways to approach this story and finally found a couple of people whose stories I could tell that really exemplified the problem. So I'm going to go in and read. This is drawn from a piece that ran in The Nation in August and was really looking at the crisis down there. So this isn't like in the bad olden days. This was, you know, this last summer. And I, you know, finally found people to profile that had a compelling story to tell. So I'm just going to buzz through a little bit of that. I think I have about 6 or 7 more minutes, I hope. So, okay. So on April 18th, 2011, New Orleans police arrested Clarence Jones, a 41-year-old black man. Clarence contends that he was walking with his cousin, Keitha Hyde, running some errands around 11:30 a.m. when he ducked into an alley to relieve himself. Quote, "It was just an empty house, so I went in the backyard out of sight," he says, talking to me from jail. And when cops turned the corner, he looked guilty. But police contend Clarence was climbing out a window with pliers in his left hand, apparently scrapping for metal or copper wiring in a gutted building. The cops arrested him and his cousin, took them to the Orleans Parish Prison. And on May 13th, nearly a month later, Clarence finally appeared before a magistrate in Orleans Parish Criminal Court. who arraigned him on the charge, simple burglary, and set his bail at $10,000 before raising it 4 days later to $20,000. Sorry, skipping ahead here. A year passed with Clarence in jail, and it passed slowly. He spent it in the Orleans Parish prison tents. Quote, "I never been appointed a lawyer," he told me in June. "They call me to court, I sit back in the docks, and they never let me in," end quote. He tried to educate himself on the law, reading from some books from the prison library, talking to other inmates, and doing some seat-of-the-pants legal work on his own behalf. Quote, "I'm not the only one back here don't have a lawyer," he says. "We get law books, so I read a few pages to see what fits my case." He tells me that he filed a motion for, quote, "discovery and inspection" to see what kind of evidence might be introduced during the trial, as well as a motion to squash, meaning quash, based on a violation of the Louisiana Code of Criminal Procedure, which says he has a right to a speedy trial. And while Clarence may be a bit off on the lingo, he's correct on the essence. The trial, quote, "the trial of a defendant charged with a felony shall commence within 120 days if he's in continued custody," quote. That's the law in the books. Clarence is doing the best he can, but after spending so many months in jail, he's growing discouraged and starting to wonder if he'll ever get out. "I think it sucks," he said. "I think if I had an attorney, I would have been home." So more than 16 months later, Clarence Jones is still in jail, still waiting for an attorney to be assigned to represent him. "It's been hell back here," he says, explaining that he's living with approximately 400 other prisoners in oversized tents that fill the prison grounds. In the aftermath of Katrina, I don't know if you guys know this, but these massive tents were put up to temporarily house prisoners down there, and the prisoners are still there 7 years later. Even worse, the Orleans Parish Prison, already notoriously violent, veered out of control as Jones languished there. Things got so bad that the U.S. Marshals Service pulled all its prisoners from the facility in March 2012. Then the Justice Department sent a letter to the New Orleans Sheriff in April citing alarming conditions in the violent and dangerous prison. The detailed list of constitutional violations runs 21 pages long. Clarence Jones puts it simply, quote, "It's like we animals. They just packing more and more people in. They got us packed to capacity. Lots of us have no attorney. Can't do nothing but sit back here. We're just stuck." So as an impoverished and incarcerated defendant in a criminal case, Clarence does have a guaranteed right to free counsel, as I said. But in Louisiana, such rights are routinely flouted. Indeed, Clarence is one of 230 people sitting in limbo in the Orleans Parish Prison this summer, after a $2 million budget shortfall forced the Orleans Parish Public Defender's Office to lay off 27 employees, 21 of them lawyers. Hundreds more are out on bond, trying to make sense of the court documents being sent to them and wondering whether they'll ever be assigned a lawyer to help. As post-Katrina federal dollars dry up and the physical crisis forces drastic budget cuts at the state and local levels, one of the hardest hit areas in New Orleans and the nation at large has been public defenders' offices. When money gets tight, the lawyers charged with protecting the rights of the poor in criminal cases are considered expendable. In New Orleans, squeezed by these budget shortfalls, Chief District Defender Derwin Bunton announced that he was laying off nearly a third of his staff. He cut the entire conflicts division, and the conflicts division are the lawyers that are appointed when there's two defendants in a case, and they can't really work out of the same office because they could be in conflict. So there's this sort of separate firewall put up in the office, and there's this whole division called the conflicts division. So if two people rob a 7-Eleven, one will get a regular attorney at the public defender's office, and one will be assigned to the conflicts office. So that entire staff was laid off, and anybody then who had a conflicts case just didn't have an attorney. So since they didn't have an attorney, any rights to a speedy trial are violated. So they're just basically sitting in jail despite this violation of their constitutional rights. Why? Well, first, it's a catch-22 for the jail defendants. Most of them need a lawyer to fully grasp how their rights are being violated and to help them make that argument in court. And second, there's some linguistic fudging going on. It's not that they're being denied officially representation. These defendants are simply on a wait list for pro bono representation. And since February of 2012, those waiting for a lawyer on the list has been as high as 543 people at a time. Third, due to quirks in Louisiana law, folks can be held up to 4 months, depending on their alleged crime, before the district attorney's office decides whether or not to even pursue the case. It's possible that some particularly proactive judge could step in and say, you have to free these people, you're violating their right to a speedy trial, but it had better be someone who doesn't mind losing the next election for being soft on crime. So that hasn't really happened. I spoke to, and you know, there's those who are charged with, you know, a more serious crime like, you know, burglary, as the guy I just spoke to. But there's also people charged who are sitting there for really, really minor crimes because they can't pay the bail or because they, again, don't have an attorney. One of those is this man, a 32-year-old guy named Willie Cheneau, who I spoke to in June. And he'd been sitting in the prison for 2 months for an arrest for a nickel bag of marijuana. And the fact that this was his second arrest bumped his charge up from a misdemeanor to a felony. And although he's poor and qualifies for a public defender, he had no one assigned. So the judge set his bail at $1,000. And to bail him out, someone would have had to pay 13% plus fees, so approximately $180. But he couldn't come up with it. And his mom, who he was living with at the time, was pissed, and she was like, sit in jail, I don't care, you know. So he couldn't come up with the $180, so he sat in jail, and he was, you know, even willing to plead guilty, but he couldn't go in to do that because he didn't have a lawyer. So, you know, finally he waits 2 months. Finally he gets a lawyer, he goes in, he pleads guilty, and, you know, is fined and released. But meanwhile, he's sat in jail for 2 months for this. The city of New Orleans has been paying an exorbitant amount of money for that, and he's lost his job. And, you know, the impact of sitting in jail can be profound for people. You lose your job, you lose your slot in a GED program, you then, you know, can't pay your rent and lose your housing, or you lose custody of your kids. So that is, you know, one of the things that I think is important as journalists is to as I said, bring that story down to a personal level to really the people that are being affected, and also to think about, I think Americans have a pretty profound sense of fairness, what's right, what's just, and I think they're generally shocked when they hear this. But it's hard to make that indignation carry over into saying we need to adequately fund the system, that these lawyers have crushing caseloads, that there are huge problems, as some of these other speakers have talked about. So they may be indignant about the issue of fairness, but then they may say, oh, but these criminals shouldn't be out on the street because it's a huge public safety issue. And it's hard to explain why this matters to people, and I think for us journalists, that's our challenge, because people think if they've been arrested, they must have committed the crime, right? They're guilty. So one of the other one woman I spoke to was a professor, a law professor at Tulane. Her name's Catherine Mattis. She had an interesting way of conceptualizing the situation and really reframing it as a public safety issue. And this goes back to, oops, I have 1 minute left. This goes back to the gentleman who mentioned the DNA exoneration, et cetera. One of the issues with public safety around this is that if the public defense system is not strong, then the wrong people are being jailed, which means the person who committed the crime is still out there. So I think that's an important part of the story to remember. And Catherine Mattis said, you know, she calls it the trickle-down theory of community safety. And she said, It's hard to measure such things, but the logic makes sense, especially when considering the social consequences of radical breakdowns in the court. And I think here, Mexico, failure of the justice system that's led to widespread corruption and disorder. As Mattis explains, quote, the public defender system is one of the most important public safety systems we have. A strong public defender who challenges the prosecutor, ensuring that he can make his case, forces the prosecutor to make sure the police are investigating and making solid arrests based on evidence, not bias, attitude, or laziness. I think it's essential for the public to understand this relationship between effective, well-funded public defense systems and their own safety. So that's one way of kind of phrasing the debate. And hopefully in the next session we can talk more about the reporting and writing aspects of this issue and the challenges around that. So,
thank you. As Justine comes, I'm reminded of a friend of mine, John McLean, who writes books about forest fires that where people die, smoke jumpers. And about a year ago, he was finishing a book about a case in California where a guy was convicted and sentenced to death. And I live in California, and so he said, this guy, it's been a year since he was sentenced to death, and he doesn't have a lawyer to handle his appeal. Is that unusual? And it sounded unusual to me, but a couple of phone calls. It used to be 6 years. Apparently they've reduced it down to about 4 years, where you don't even get assigned a lawyer for 4 years. And that's usually we think of death penalty cases as getting some of the most attention. 4 years before you even get a lawyer to handle your appeal. Anyway, holistic defense. What is holistic defense?
Well, you'll find out shortly. I don't want him to feel alone, so I'm going to stay seated. Sure. When I walked back... Is that on? Can you hear me? When I walked back through the heavy metal door that led from the courtroom to the jail cells right behind, I expected that the person that I was going to meet would be a hardened young man. And it made sense that I would expect that. The file that I held in my hand said that this person who was about to be my client had, over the course of a single month period, committed 5 knife point robberies. And in one of those robberies, the person had refused to give up their wallet. And my soon-to-be client was accused of taking out that knife and stabbing the person multiple times. But when that door slammed behind me and I sat in that dingy attorney interview booth and I looked through the metal grate that separated me from him, I didn't see a hardened, dangerous young man. I saw a soft, round-faced boy. He sat on the other side of the gate, looking down at the ground, his feet making circles on the floor, his fingers fidgeting with one another, and he looked up at me. My name is Justine Olderman. I'm an attorney with the Bronx Defenders, and I'm going to be your lawyer. Within seconds, his big brown eyes filled with tears that he could not hold back, and they just began to fall across his cheeks and onto his lap. I knew after talking to Trevor for just a few minutes that it was going to be incredibly challenging to secure his release that day. But I also knew that I had to do everything in my power to do that. Not just because who sat across from me was a child, and those eyes and those tears running down his face made my heart literally hurt, but because from practicing in the criminal justice system in the South Bronx for 13 years, there are a lot of things that I know about bail. They're the things that you've heard here today from all the other speakers. I knew first that if bail were set, Trevor and his family weren't going to be able to make it. in the Bronx, there was this Human Rights Watch report that came out. Actually, this is citywide. And the statistics show that even in New York City, 88.7% of people who have bail set at $1,000 cannot post their bail at that first arraignment. The second thing that I knew about Trevor is that if bail had been set on him, the chances were he was going to result in a felony, his case was going to result in a felony conviction that in New York, with no expungement statute, was going to follow him the rest of his days. Because the statistics also show that you are two times as likely to end up with a conviction if you're held in on bail. Third, I knew that he was likely to do state prison time. This is a young man of just 16 years. Because you are three times more likely to end up with an incarceratory sentence if you are held in on bail than if you're convicted and you're out. And fourth, because I knew that ROR, release on recognizance for Trevor, was his only chance. There's a saying among defense attorneys that once you're out, you stay out. And I knew that to be true in his case, that if I could get him out that day, chances were he was never going back in. He was going to be offered an alternative to incarceration, and he'd probably walk away without a criminal conviction at all. The effect of bail that you've heard here today is nothing short of unconscionable. It is the single most important factor in a criminal case. It not only all but dictates what the outcome of the case is going to be, not guilt, not innocent, not evidence, not witnesses, but bail not only dictates the outcome, but the consequences that Karen just mentioned briefly on our clients' lives is nothing short of devastating. For somebody like Trevor, obviously, it means being separated from his entire support system, his mother, his siblings, being denied the educational opportunities that await him on the outside. But for most of our clients that I see every single day, this is very real. This isn't hypothetical or theoretical. Every single day, that single decision that is made in a split second at that first court appearance results and people losing their jobs, losing their housing. 24 hours in New York City held in on bail is enough for ICE to drop a detainer on somebody and for our clients who are legal permanent residents to be deported sometimes to countries they have not seen since they were children. And yes, it can result in a child being taken away from their parent. If there is nobody to care for my client's child, in New York, the Administration from Children's Services has no choice but to open a neglect case against my client and put that child in foster care. Not to mention loss of benefits, employment opportunities, educational opportunities, and the implications for clients and their families as husbands are separated from wives and parents from children for days, weeks, months, even years waiting for the resolution of their case is simply unconscionable. So the question naturally is, what should we be doing about it? And Norman mentioned this in passing, that really the defense bar, as a defense attorney, there is so much more that we can be doing. There wasn't much talk about it today at this panel, but Chief Judge Lipman, in his State of the Judiciary, talked about it yesterday, and this is being written about all over the country, that people are screaming that the answer to this is changes in bail statutes that provide for keeping people incarcerated who are deemed danger to the community, as well as creating a system like they have in Washington, D.C., in the federal court system of pretrial supervision. That is not the answer, certainly not in New York, as far as I'm concerned, and there are a couple of reasons for that. The first is that the notion of pretrial supervision, all it does is it casts an ever-widening net on a population of people, the people I represent in the South Bronx, and most people who cycle in and out of the criminal justice system in every city, in every county, in every state across this country are poor people of color. They share a lot of things in common. Almost universally, they come from under-resourced communities where they are forced day in and day out to navigate an intricate web of bureaucracies and city agencies so that they can access basic services for their families, health insurance, benefits, housing. To create another bureaucracy that people have to navigate is simply not the answer. Not only is it not the answer because it creates more governmental and quasi-governmental control over a population of people that are already suffering in the communities that they live in, but in addition, it will strap an already overburdened court system with people coming in and day out, arguing about whether our clients have been in compliance with the mandates of their supervision and litigating violations of supervised release. In New York in particular, and I can't speak as well as other people on the panel can about what other jurisdictions have in their bail statutes, but in New York, at least currently, and this may not be the case next year, but currently in New York, danger to the community is not one of the factors for bail. Our bail statute actually has all of the tools that we already need to ensure that the vast majority of people can be released either on their own recognizance or with some sort of bail package that will, in fact, secure their release from jail. And the reason for that is multifold. Like I said, we don't allow for detention based on danger to the community. It's only based on what is necessary to secure somebody's return to court. That's it. And New York's bail statute, unlike other jurisdictions, has individualized bail factors that judges are required to consider. Things as specific as somebody's, not just their ties to the community, their family history, their employment context, as well as their financial resources. And New York doesn't have any laminated charts. Judges are allowed to set bail based in any amount they want, and there are 9 different types of bail that they get to choose from so that they can make the bail package individualized to that particular person, so that they can answer the question of what ensures this person's release and yet guarantees as much as possible their return to court. And there's a lot of this discussion about fear about returning to court and danger to the community. What I can tell you from practicing day in and day out is in New York City, 94% of people return to court on their own. The crisis of people leaving the criminal justice system and never coming back is not based in statistical reality. And while there are lots of organizations that are working very hard to come up with actuarial risk assessments to be able to predict dangerousness, as Norman mentioned in discussing this issue, the idea of adding safety to the community is one of those factors that once it gets put on the books, and I do certainly fear that this is going to happen in New York, once it gets put on the books, that becomes an excuse. People's own senses of what they fear, a judge sitting on the bench, what they fear, honestly, is having you all put their name in the paper. And that becomes a proxy for dangerousness. I guarantee you, Trevor, to most judges, would have seemed like a danger to that community. And he, as you will learn, was anything but. Understandably, many people, when they talk about what is the answer to this question, say, well, these are services. If we engaged in something like pretrial supervision, aren't these services that your clients need? Aren't they services that they might want? And the answer to that is perhaps, but it's not a quasi-governmental agency that should be identifying those needs or providing them. There's been a lot of discussion about the unmet call of Gideon. And there are ways in which we as a defense bar can do better than we have. But that is the role of the defense attorney. That is not the role of a government agency. We are in the best position on the front lines, interacting with our clients at that very worst moment of their lives, to be able to identify the root causes of their involvement in the criminal justice system, as well as to identify what are these consequences that they now face as a result of being here, and how can we protect them from them. And that brings me to the topic that I was asked to talk about in a very roundabout way, which is holistic defense. What is holistic defense? A traditional public defender model focuses on the client's case and would spend the time with their client back at that first meeting figuring out where the witness is. What kind of challenges can I make to the evidence that the people want to introduce in the case? What kind of defenses can we come up with together? Where can I send my investigator to try to find out what the lighting conditions were like and whether there was really an opportunity to observe? Holistic defense is a different model. Holistic defense says Yes, we need to and we must ask all those questions. But it is not enough just to defend the client's case. You have to defend the whole client. And by doing so, you do get at the root causes of their involvement in the criminal justice system and help protect them from the devastating consequences of that involvement. That is the true calling of the public defender. Now, the very first place where we have an opportunity to employ that is, in fact, on the issue of pretrial detention. So when we go back, and just to back up for a second, there are sort of two ways that I think when it comes to pretrial detention, holistic defense has many different elements to it. It involves ensuring access to services for clients, creating dynamic and open communication among the defense attorney and the other legal and non-legal service providers that clients are connected with. It requires being able to identify what these issues are. And it also involves being rooted in the community, because every client community is going to be different. What brings that community's members into the criminal justice system and what they face once they're there is going to vary from place to place and locality to locality. So those are all key components. But where they come together when it comes to criminal justice and pretrial detention is in two ways. One is in an individualized way. In other words, how do we bring that recognition that we have to defend the whole client to bear on that moment of the decision about whether somebody gets held in? And the other piece is a systemic one. When Karen was talking, the sort of light bulb went off of, like, how do I communicate this from lawyer to journalist? And she talked about narrative and context, right? And in many ways, it's the same thing for us. The narrative piece is the need to understand the client. So, in other words, I go back and I have that interview with the client, and I'm going to ask them a whole host of questions. In addition to their case, I'm going to ask them about their family. I'm going to ask them about their community. I'm going to ask about their housing situation, their employment, their educational history. I'm going to ask them about their mental and physical well-being. I'm going to ask them about any history of drug addiction or any current alcohol abuse that they're struggling with. And from that picture, I'm going to get a sense not only of where they are as a snapshot right now, but what do I need to know are the risks when they go out and see that judge if that judge ends up setting bail on them. Why do we do this? Why is it so important for us to capture this for pretrial detention issues? For three reasons. One, it's one hell of a motivator as a defense attorney. Because when you know a person, it is hard not to want to fight with every ounce of energy you have in you for that person's freedom. It allows us to explain to the court what brings them to the criminal justice doorstep and why they don't need to be concerned about releasing them into the community. And it allows us to educate judges about what the consequences are. You would be shocked at how little the judiciary knows and understands about the implications of simply setting bail. Most judges don't follow a case all the way through in New York. They sit for the arraignment, and they never see that client again. They don't know what the consequences are, and so it gives us an opportunity to, in that individualized moment, to articulate to the judge just what will happen to that client if, in fact, the judge sets bail on them. The contextual piece, the sort of more systemic piece, is also critical. As holistic defenders, in touch with what happens to our clients, in touch with their needs, in touch with the consequences they face in the criminal justice system, and in touch with their communities, we can use that knowledge, and armed with that knowledge, we can fight for reform bail practices. Doing nothing, changing nothing to the law whatsoever, all of the public defender offices spearheaded by the Bronx Defenders last year created a bail initiative. And the bail initiative was designed to figure out what could we do about the problem of bail in New York City. And one of the first things we identified, as I mentioned, these nine forms of bail, judges in New York sit two, cash or insurance company bond, the most onerous forms of bail for our clients to post. What happened to the other seven forms of bail? Nobody was using them. So we set about to understand why. And we realized that it's because judges just simply didn't know about them. So we went into clerk's offices around the city, and we went into their clerk drawers, and we pulled out these dusty old forms from 1972 when New York's bail statute was first passed. And sure enough, they were there. They didn't have the mark of a defense attorney on them. These were governmental forms. And we went back around to the judiciary. We went back around to the clerks in all the boroughs. And we trained the judges and we trained the clerks. We created bail fact sheets, which I have here, to educate judges about what the intent of the bail statute is, about the ramifications of the decisions that they make in those split seconds as somebody appears before them and is quickly led away. And that alone, even just that, has made a noticeable difference in New York City. So being a holistic defender and understanding the individual client, what brings them here, what are the consequences they face now that they're here, not only helps us advocate on an individual level, but helps us make change on a more systemic level. When I went back and talked to Trevor that afternoon, I did what I'd been trained to do. I asked about all of the legal aspects of his case, but I spent the bulk of my time talking to him about who he was, who his family was, and what brought him here. And this is what I learned. Trevor had grown up in the South Bronx with his mother and his younger brother. His mother was employed and was always able to support the family. But she became pregnant when Trevor was 16 and his little brother was 14. She didn't think she could anymore, so she was as surprised about it as anybody. But there she was, pregnant, and as her pregnancy grew on and became more complicated, she was unable to work. And her job let her go. And over time, she could no longer support herself and her sons living in that apartment. Fearing the destabilizing impact that it would have if they all had to move into the shelter system, she came up with what she thought would be a temporary and good resolution. She rented out her room in the apartment and moved in with her boyfriend. Trevor was living alone, caring for himself and his 14-year-old brother when I met him. He had been living like that for approximately 4 months. His mother came in the morning, she made them breakfast, got them off to school, and came back in the afternoon to help them with their homework and feed them dinner. But then she went back to her home, and Trevor and his brother were left to take care of themselves. And over time, the burden of this and the sense of responsibility that Trevor felt as the oldest man in the house became too much, and he dropped out of school, and he fell into a deep depression. His mother did what she could. She sought counseling out for him. She found an alternative school for him, and the day I met him, he was supposed to start that new school the following Monday. But the sense of responsibility was too great for Trevor, and so when his little brother went to sleep on 5 different nights, he took a kitchen knife from the drawer, and he went outside, and he stole, and he robbed. And he took that money, and as we sat there in that dingy interview booth, that money was still sitting in a shoebox underneath his bed, waiting for an opportunity to give it to the landlord so that his mother could move back in with him. When I went out to see the judge that afternoon, what I explained to her is that Trevor did what he thought he had to do. And as I stood up there, I was motivated by feeling like I had to do what I needed to get him out. And so I explained what brought him to the criminal justice system's doorstep. I explained that he was here for love and poverty. I also explained what the consequences would be if she did, in fact, set bail on him. And I set forth all the resources that we would bring to bear for Trevor and his family to ensure that we address the issues that brought him into the criminal justice system and protected him from the devastating consequences of that involvement. I told her that we would connect him to a social worker, that we'd get him back into counseling. We'd ensure that he went to that school program the following Monday, that his mother would be connected with a housing attorney and a benefits counselor to help her get the money that she needed. There aren't many judges, I have to tell you, who would have done what she did. But she released him. And last week, I was on my way out to court, and I was walking through the lobby, and there was a young man sitting in the lobby. He was wearing khaki pants with a nice crease down the front and a blue button-down shirt and a tie. And his hand rested on a baby carrier. And he was rocking back and forth an infant with a pink little hat on her head. And he looked up at me, and he smiled. And I recognized those eyes, and they didn't have tears in them anymore. Trevor had gotten out. He had gone to school that Monday. And he and his mother were living back together in their apartment. She had been connected with a lawyer who helped her with her housing issues. She had been connected with a benefits counselor who got her an increase in her monthly allowance. There's been some talk and mention today, and there will be a lot more that you'll hear about Gideon's promise. When I walked through the lobby that day, that's an example of holistic defense. And in my mind, that is Gideon's promise.
So we've got about 10 or 15 minutes before they're going to force us to leave. So let's.
I wanted to ask Tim a question and then open up to questions. So we've heard this description of this terrible problem. You have the data that shows that it works. It's proven to work. Why? What is the resistance? Why are you still fighting this fight to get this? Why isn't it a standard fixture? Across the country?
It's a great question, and it's one that if I knew the answer, I would address it and get on with another job where I could be happier with it. Undeniably, this reform is different than any that you have heard about with regard to criminal justice, because this reform and only this reform has a natural enemy. Years ago, I worked on the first drug court in Miami. For all the people whose head exploded when you introduced the idea of drug treatment as a tool that could be used in the criminal justice system, we didn't have people actually spending money trying to thwart drug treatment. We have people who spend money trying to drum down pretrial justice reform, and that's the very people who profit financially from the current system. The bail-for-profit industry is tiny. It's got deep pockets. It's got lots and lots of fluidity. And they hook up, as any industry would, with elected officials and maintain their stranglehold on how justice is administered. It's remarkable to me that as you go around the country and you talk to judges and prosecutors and defenders, you could almost always get them to cry. You could almost always get them to stand up and salute the flag with you. But then when you get to lead them out the door, they go, whoops, hold it, Tim, but I didn't tell you. It's different here. See, in my community, we're conservative. It doesn't matter where you go. They tell you the same speech. And we're a very law and order-oriented community, and the media will just barbecue us if we actually follow the law or if we actually are rational in our decision-making. And the bonding industry preys upon this misperception. We just finished, for the first time in history, national public opinion polling, and when we introduced the notion of risk assessment that would determine release based on the probability of staying out of trouble and doing what you're supposed to do, as opposed to basing release on the number of dollars you have in your pocket, the public generally thought we were making decisions based on risk assessment anyway. When we explained to them, no, we got 2 out of 3 people in jail or there because they can't purchase their freedom, the general public's response, white, black, boy, girl, Democrat, Republican, was, why on earth would you run a system like that? And the only answer I have for them, guys, is, oh, we thought you wanted us to. We thought that's how you defined law and order. And it turns out the public defines law and order much the same as the rest of us.
Okay, if I can ask you to ask your questions very briefly, and we'll get really quick answers.
And quick answers, right?
Oh, great. This was fascinating.
Tell us who you are.
Oh, Gloria Brown Marshall. I'm an associate professor here, as well as a former civil rights litigator and a freelance journalist on legal issues. My concern is, this is a great panel. Many of you, and Tim just said, he talked to politicians and spoken with judges and prosecutors. It would have been interesting to have one of them represented here on this panel. I've heard from you what their position happens to be, but is that something you thought about it at one point? Because when we're writing these stories, you know, it's you know, necessary, I think, for us to say we had a chance to speak
that's
with.
That's really a question that's to me, because we set up the panel, not the speakers. So I plead guilty. We did want to get the issue itself out of the problem of pretrial detention or release and the question of indigent defense. But we will go back to this issue, and we'll get a more holistic, if I can use that word, response with prosecutors. We're hoping, in fact, to do that, to get a series of activities for journalists to talk about the entire spectrum of the system.
Thank you. I'm Wayne Ezell, editorial writer from Jacksonville, Florida.
Wayne?
Oh. Where we have a couple thousand people in jail, most under the circumstances that you've described. My question is, I'm hearing all of this, and by the way, just a tremendous panel. Where's the ACLU and the lawsuits that would seem to me would change this?
The ACLU's attention in criminal justice reform has been focused predominantly on sentencing and the mass incarceration that's symbolized by our nation's prisons. And there's plenty to do in both the realm of sentencing and the other. They have, within the last year or so, rolled up their sleeves and gotten vigorously involved with front-end decision-making. I'll be honest with you. This is the least sexy, the least glamorous of all the criminal justice stuff. It's like bail. Well, that doesn't matter, does it? I mean, it's the price of crime, isn't it? And it's only temporary. The real meat, the rubber meets the road when we get to sentencing and there's litigation and there's courtrooms and there's all this other stuff. You guys and many, many jurisdictions around the country, bail is set in a basement with no lawyers. The person setting bail isn't even law trained, but you've heard. And by the way, if I ever get arrested, the dying request I have is I want to be represented by these two people, and I want her to cover the story, huh?
Well, just very briefly, I don't speak for the ACLU, but we work in partnership with them on many of our indigent defense reform efforts, and they are involved in litigation in a number of different jurisdictions around the country on the issue of access to counsel.
They did some they were successful in Montana.
Yeah.
They did some work in Michigan.
They're working in Michigan now, Montana. It looks like they may be doing something in Pennsylvania and also in Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Just such an outrage.
So your state's a fascinating example. We polled Republican only, likely to vote, citizens in Florida about this whole pretrial justice thing, and they're on our side. Yet you go to virtually any court in Florida, take your breath away.
Well, the bonding industry.
Take your breath
away. The bonding industry is very powerful
in
Florida.
Yeah, the bonding industry. They introduce legislation, bill after bill, state after state, eliminating judicial discretion, requiring that somebody pay them to get out of jail. And keep in mind, ladies and gentlemen, this is a system where each subsequent alleged crime generates more profit. I mean, really, you cannot justify any of this and say, well, it's a good try. I'm sorry.
Next question.
Good afternoon. I would first like to say that what an excellent panel up there. I could listen at you all day long. My name is Beatrice Hudgens Middleton. I'm with the Healing Hearts Administration Ministry. And my question to you this afternoon is how are prosecutors and judges held accountable when a person is being detained based upon an accusatory instrument which is insufficient on its face and cannot be amended according to the law?
The answer is they're absolutely immune.
They're immune.
End of story.
They're immune from damages. They're immune from lawsuits.
Michael Kiefer from the Arizona Republic. As a wrinkle on this, in Arizona, they passed a law denying bond to illegal immigrants accused of Class 4 felonies. Then everything they were arrested for became Class 4 felony, and they invented some new laws to make sure that that's the way it was. And what would happen is then they would stay in jail for about 100 days. Then they'd get the meet and plead, and they would be asked to plead to a Class 6 undesignated felony and deported. So the county attorney, Andrew Thomas, who's since been disbarred but for other reasons, was very smug about this as an efficient deportation machine. And I would venture to say that, you know, this is a system that what you're describing that favors the prosecution. It makes it more efficient for them because, again, it feeds right into the whole plead them out, no trial.
Before you comment on that, let me go to another question.
I'm Brendan Kirby from Mobile. I had a couple questions. I guess virtually everywhere there's a mechanism for going back to a judge and asking for a bail review hearing, saying my client can't meet the bail,
yeah.
You know, lower it. Is that something that lawyers just don't do, or judges don't listen to? And
oftentimes there's no lawyer to go back.
Yeah.
Oftentimes they will corral us all together on disposition day, on a disposition calendar, take us in, and we all stand up and plead guilty, as was described, with no lawyer. So there is no one model that's replicated from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. But it's not unusual for you to get arrested, charged with a criminal offense, and you'll see a lawyer when you're standing there pleading for the first time.
And then just real quick, if I could, when you talk about the likelihood that someone who stays in jail is going to end up going to prison versus getting out, is there been any tests to try and determine whether that's a correlation or a causation? Is it because of the jail that causes that, or is there something particular about poorer people that can't afford the bail that are more likely for other reasons to go on?
It's causal and causal only, but there's emerging research that does show it's correlation, not causal, excuse me. But there is research that will hit light and air this year that does show pretrial incarceration, even for a ridiculously small amount of time, think about her client, right, has a causal effect with regard to recidivism.
Absolutely.
So the system we're using to protect all of you from all these crooks, unless they have money, is actually making more crooks.
Just one thing that I want to, on the appeal issue, I will tell you that even in New York City, part of our bail initiative, I hate to say it, but, you know, it's a safe space, is that we need to educate ourselves. Honestly, most of the lawyers that I go around the city and do trainings with don't know about everything that's available in terms of taking those appeals. But a couple of other things, just some factors to think about, is that at least in New York, studies have shown that the single most important factor in determining what bail a judge sets is what the prosecutor asks.
Right.
Okay. So there's no correlation. This is not about following the statute. This is not about – prosecutors certainly aren't asking for the amount of bail they ask for because they're worried that the client's not going to come back to court, right? That's not what motivates them. It's plea bargaining, and they know it gives them so much of an upper hand. So there's also underneath all of this is, you know, the institution of prosecutors and judges and that relationship between the two and the power dynamic that's inherent in that relationship. Those are two incredibly important factors that influence – everything else that we've been talking about.
You know, there are places in this country where it isn't permissible for a guilty plea to be entered at the first appearance, and that's what we ought to have here in New York, because it's exactly what Justine says. The prosecutors use that as a tool. The court system uses it as a tool. I have seen Office of Court Administration statistics where they rate judges to the 100th of a point on their disposition rate. That's not justice.
Candace, briefly.
Where is that? Where does that happen? Where is it not permissible?
Well, for one thing, the one state that I know of where it's not permissible is, I believe, Kentucky.
If you go to the District of Columbia, they use absolutely no money bond, so that means a lot of people get out. And so what we're trying to tell you is, regardless of what public officials say publicly, what terrorizes them is not that the city's going to burn because they release somebody. It's that they're not going to be able to manage their dockets. The prosecutor won't. The judge won't. And that's how they are judged. And the defense counsel
Tim's right.
Can't either. It terrifies them. But if you take 95 and go south for a couple of hours and you walk into Superior Court, they have people who have been released pretrial who come in and plea just the same as they did when you had them in chains, without the social and fiscal costs.
Absolutely right. You know, the thing that we, you know, the panel is, you know, we tried to cover it a lot, but we didn't cover everything. The really biggest problem that we have, especially in the misdemeanor courts, is that we're prosecuting too much. We need to reclassify, some say decriminalize. That is really, it's killing our indigent defense system. It's causing this mass incarceration. And as has been mentioned a couple of times, these misdemeanors end up causing much worse outcomes later on for those individuals, just in terms of the collateral consequences, later bail determinations, and later sentences.
I had a quick question about with D.C. not having the bonds. And so is there anything kind of comparing Andrea Noble with the Washington Times. So curious about that. With is there any kind of sort of studies on the recidivism rates or things like that?
Sure.
You know, with D.C. versus everyone always compares us to states, so I don't know, maybe a city of comparable size or something like that in terms of places where people are staying in jail.
The D.C. Pretrial Services Agency, a publicly funded agency, routinely publishes its statistical outcomes. You can see the current quarter or go back a number of years. They're among the best in the country in terms of the data they keep and its credibility. The rest of the justice system uses their numbers for an awful lot of stuff. Their failure to appear rate is just under 10%. It's between 8 and 9%. Their rearrest rate is a similar, just by coincidence, figure. Those are good numbers. If you have a program that says, I have a 2% failure to appear rate, they have the Virgin Mary locked up. They're not releasing anybody. And if you have one that says that they're releasing 25%, then you should get a new program.
So I just want to tell you, the reason I'm asking you for you to identify your names is because not only are we live streaming this, but we have a podcast of each of the panels that you've heard today and yesterday, and we'll be posting those podcasts online on our site probably by next week. So those of you who've taken good notes probably won't need it, but this is a good reference point for our fellows and everyone else.
And I apologize for being such a wallflower, but I feel myself coming out.
You were a bit shy. You were. But
the interesting thing about D.C., is that money bond is permissible. There's absolutely nothing on the books that prohibits a judge from issuing a money bond or the U.S. attorney, who's the local prosecutor, as you know, from requesting money bond. They just don't do it. And why would they not do it? Because it doesn't do anything except separate those who have money from those who don't. It accomplishes virtually nothing else.
So I have to say that I really disagree with Tim. This really is a sexy story. and it's proof that there's a lot more of this that we can get into. We have to cut it off. But I want to thank Tim, Norm, Justine, and Karen for a fantastic introduction to a really complicated subject, which I hope all of you will explore for this 50th year of Gideon v. Wainwright. So thank them, and of course, Maurice, for a fantastic panel.